Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, you will hear about important things that are happening around the world. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we turn to a problem that affects many Africans, the forced marriage of young girls. The African Union is working to stop this troubling practice. Then, we are off to the western state of California to learn about two large ethnic groups. Some experts point out that while there are many cultural differences, there are also many similarities. 7 days a week, we give you our world as it is. In most African countries, at least 30% of all girls are married before they reach age 18. Many of these girls become a man's wife against their will. The high number of young wives has led the African Union to launch a 2-year campaign to end child marriage in Africa. Parents in developing countries force 14 million girls below the age of 18 to get married each year. Most of these countries are in Africa. Zinabu is a 16-year-old girl from Niger. She says that she was taken out of school by her parents to get married. She says her husband beat her if she did not want him to touch her. She ran away to her parents, but they also beat her and returned her to her husband. She later ran away to another family member and now wants to return to school. Girls married at a young age often develop mental disorders. They may also suffer other health problems because of an early pregnancy, and they are less likely to get an education. Most of the girls come from poorly educated families and rural areas where young women cannot oppose cultural traditions. The African Union campaign to end child marriage is aimed at policy action and on raising understanding of the problem. Olawale Mayegun is the director of the AU's Social Affairs Commission. He says AU member countries should follow and enforce laws and policies that protect children.
The Charter on the Rights of the Child, for example, has clear provisions on harmful practices against the child. And it's clear in the provisions of the Charter, culture or religious or whatever should not be an excuse, and the states must take measures to eliminate them. People use all sorts of excuses to perpetuate what they're doing, but it's not an excuse as far as the Commission is concerned.
Among African countries, child marriage rates are highest in Niger and Chad. The rates there are above 70%. In Zambia, the rate is 42%. 10 government ministries are working together to bring that rate down. Nkandu Luo is the Zambian Minister of Chiefs and Traditional Affairs.
The reason we felt that the chiefs should be the ones is because it hinges on customary law, and there's also a belief that it is to do with our cultures. When any parent is reported to the chief, first of all, they appear before the chief because there's the traditional court. So they appear before the traditional court and they are charged according to the decision by the traditional court. But they also make sure they go and take that child out of marriage and put her back into school.
The End Child Marriage campaign is done in cooperation with African governments, civil society organizations, and the United Nations Children's Fund. More immigrants live in the western state of California than anywhere else in the United States. Among the largest immigrant groups are Mexicans and Chinese. The two ethnic groups come from very different places, but they share many similarities. 21-year-old Jonathan Wong is a fourth-generation Chinese and a third-generation Mexican-American. But people often wonder about his ancestry.
They go, "Are you Filipino? Are you Mexican? Are you Pacific Islander? Are you Hawaiian?"
Although the cultures of his ancestors are very different, Jonathan Wong finds there is one thing both deeply value.
The connection you have with your family in general, both of them are very family-oriented.
Like many immigrants, his Mexican and Chinese ancestors came to the U.S. for a better life. Shelley Fisher Fishkin is director of the American Studies Program at Stanford University in California.
The Chinese who came to the U.S. in the middle of the 19th century and then Mexicans who came at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, were lured by the possibility of creating opportunities for their families that were not possible in their home countries.
The new immigrants often faced hardship and discrimination. They worked as laborers, either as modern-day Mexican farm workers or as Chinese railroad workers in the 19th century. An art show examines the two immigrant experiences. The exhibit can be seen at the Chinese American Museum in Los Angeles. One artwork has railroad tracks buried under a small mountain of fortune cookies. Artist Hung Liu created the work. It is meant to represent the early Chinese immigrants who came to dig for gold or work on the railroads.
The very reason the Chinese first came here is to escape from the economic despair in China.
Stephen Wong is the curator of the Chinese American Museum. He says immigrants from China and Mexico still come to the U.S. He adds that immigration remains an important issue.
I think not a lot of people realize that there still is a lot of unskilled labor coming in from both communities. And not a lot of people know, too, when it comes to immigration and immigration reform, usually people associate that with, oh, that's a Latino issue. But that is also a big Asian issue of undocumented immigrants coming in, also specifically Chinese.
In the Los Angeles area, both groups often live in ethnic neighborhoods. Artist Tony De Los Reyes experienced this while growing up in Los Angeles. Mostly Mexican, East Los Angeles is one ethnic area. Next to it is Monterey Park, a mainly Chinese community. While these immigrant groups may live near each other, Tony says the two do not often mix.
You're going to have this push and pull between not wanting to be in a place because culture is different, and then also being attracted to it.
But Jonathan Wong says such borders are becoming less clearly defined. That is why he is not surprised that his parents met and got married.
Look how much blending there is, and it's not even weird at all, how they would have met or how they could have, came across each other and, hit it off.
He expects more mixing of the two cultures in other parts of the United States as immigrants and their families continue to seek the American dream. That's all for today, but please come back again tomorrow for another As It Is program on VOA. World news is yours at the beginning of the hour. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. Sunni Muslim militants have been putting pressure on the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Officials in both Baghdad and Washington are concerned about the militant group ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. The recent successes of the group also are of concern to Al-Qaeda, its one-time ally. Last winter, Al-Qaeda leaders disowned ISIL and its leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi for refusing to obey orders. They criticized his goal of creating a borderless caliphate, or Islamic State, across parts of Iraq, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. On Sunday, in an audio recording, ISIL declared itself an Islamic State without the words Iraq and the Levant. The group named its chief as the Caliph, or Head of State, and Leader for Muslims Everywhere. After the announcement, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi asked all Muslims to move in and join the fighting in Iraq and Syria. The declaration of the caliphate is likely to intensify the dispute between ISIL and Al-Qaeda. Aaron Zellin is a Middle East expert. He wrote that the two groups are now in an open war for supremacy of the global jihadist movement. In his words, ISIL holds an advantage, but the battle is not over yet. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy reported his comments. With its recent success in Iraq, ISIL has increased its standing among jihadi or Islamist groups worldwide. Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis is a jihadist group based in the Sinai Peninsula. It has been supportive of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The group claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing in Egypt earlier this year. The attack killed 3 South Koreans and injured more than 10 other people. In North Africa, Ansar al-Sharia groups have published pro-ISIL messages on the Internet. Jihadists in the Gaza Strip have also expressed support for the ISIL leader. Charles Lister is a visiting fellow with the Brookings Doha Center. He says the declaration of a caliphate by ISIL poses a huge threat to Al-Qaeda and its longtime position of leadership of the international jihadist cause. In his words, taken globally, the younger generation of the jihadist community is becoming more and more supportive of ISIL. We will very likely find ourselves in a dualistic position of having 2 competing international jihadist representatives, Al-Qaeda, with a now more locally focused and gradual approach to success, and the Islamic State, with a hunger for rapid results and total hostility for competition. The pressure on Iraq's central government is more immediate. The government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has asked the United States for airstrikes against the ISIL without success. The Iraqis are now turning to Russia for help. Luqman Faley is the Iraqi ambassador to the U.S. He says, "We have a need. There is a void. If the U.S. can't fill that void, whomever is available, including Russia, then they are welcome to fill that void." President Barack Obama is not taking any chances. On Monday, he announced he is sending more troops to Iraq to protect the U.S. embassy and the Baghdad airport. The troop deployment brought to nearly 800 the number of U.S. forces in Iraq. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Today, we begin a new series from a book by American writer Edgar Rice Burroughs. The book is called A Princess of Mars. It is the first book in a series that Mr. Burroughs wrote about a man who travels to Mars during the last years of the 1800s. There, the man meets strange beings and sees strange sights. At first, he is a captive, then a warrior, and after many battles, a prince of a royal family. Shep O'Neill begins the story of A Princess of Mars.
I am a very old man. How old, I do not know. It is possible I am 100, maybe more. I cannot tell, because I have never aged as other men do. So far as I can remember, I have always been a man of about 30. I appear today as I did 40 years ago. Yet, I feel that I cannot go on living forever. Someday, I will die the real death from which there is no escape. I do not know why I should fear death, I, who have died 2 times, and am still alive. I have never told this story. I know the human mind will not believe what it cannot understand. I cannot explain what happened to me. I can only tell of the 10 years my dead body lay undiscovered in an Arizona cave. My name is John Carter. I am from the state of Virginia. At the close of the Civil War, I found myself without a home, without money, and without work. I decided the best plan was to search for gold in the great deserts of the American Southwest. I spent almost a year searching for gold with another former soldier, Captain James Powell, also of Virginia. We were extremely lucky. In the winter of 1865, we found rocks that held gold. Powell was trained as a mining engineer. He said we had uncovered over $1 million worth of gold in only 3 months. But the work was slow, with only 2 men and not much equipment. So we decided Powell should go to the nearest settlement to seek equipment and men to help us with the work. On March 3rd, 1866, Powell said goodbye. He rode his horse down the mountain toward the valley. I followed his progress for several hours. The morning Powell left was like all mornings in the deserts of the great Southwest, clear and beautiful. Not much later, I looked across the valley. I was surprised to see 3 riders in the same place where I had last seen my friend. After watching for some time, I decided the 3 riders must be hostile Indians. Powell, I knew, was well-armed and an experienced soldier, but I knew he would need my aid. I found my weapons, placed a saddle on my horse, and started as fast as possible down the trail taken by Powell. I followed as quickly as I could until dark. About 9 o'clock, the moon became very bright. I had no difficulty following Powell's trail. I soon found the trail left by the three riders following Powell. I knew they were Indians. I was sure they wanted to capture Powell. Suddenly, I heard shots far ahead of me. I hurried ahead as fast as I could. Soon, I came to a small camp. Several hundred Apache Indians were in the center of the camp. I could see Powell on the ground. I did not even think about what to do. I just acted. I pulled out my guns and began shooting. The Apaches were surprised and fled. I forced my horse into the camp and toward Powell. I reached down and pulled him up on the horse by his belt. I urged the horse to greater speed. The Apaches, by now, realized that I was alone and quickly began to follow. We were soon in very rough country. The trail I chose began to rise sharply. It went up and up. I followed the trail for several hundred meters more until I came to the mouth of a large cave. It was almost morning now. I got off my horse and laid Powell on the ground. I tried to give him water, but it was no use. Powell was dead. I laid his body down and continued to the cave. I began to explore the cave. I was looking for a safe place to defend myself, or perhaps for a way out, but I became very sleepy. It was a pleasant feeling. My body became extremely heavy. I had trouble moving. Soon, I had to lay down against the side of the cave. For some reason, I could not move my arms or legs. I lay facing the opening of the cave. I could see part of the trail that had led me here. And now, I could see the Apaches. They had found me, but I could do nothing. Within a minute, one of them came into the cave. He looked at me, but he came no closer. His eyes grew wide. His mouth opened. He had a look of terror on his face. He looked behind me for a moment and then fled. Suddenly, I heard a low noise behind me. So could the rest of the Apaches. They all turned and fled. The sound became louder, but still I could not move. I could not turn my head to see what was behind me. All day, I lay like this. I tried again to rise, and again, but I still could not move. Then I heard a sharp sound. It was like a steel wire breaking. I quickly stood up. My back was against the cave wall. I looked down. There before me lay my body. For a few moments, I stood looking at my body. I could not bring myself to touch it. I was very frightened. The sounds of the cave and the sight of my body forced me away. I slowly backed to the opening of the cave. I turned to look at the Arizona night. I could see 1,000 stars. As I stood there, I turned my eyes to a large red star. I could not stop looking at it. It was Mars, the red planet, the red god of war. It seemed to pull me near. Then, For a moment, I closed my eyes. There was an instant of extreme cold and total darkness. Suddenly, I was in deep, dreamless, peaceful sleep. I opened my eyes upon a very strange land. I immediately knew then I was on Mars. Not once did I question this fact. My mind told me I was on Mars, as your mind tells you that you are upon Earth. You do not question the fact. Nor did I. I found myself lying on a bed of yellow-colored grass that covered the land for kilometers. The time was near the middle of the day, and the sun was shining full upon me. It was warm. I decided to do a little exploring. Springing to my feet, I received my first Martian surprise. The effort to stand carried me into the Martian air to the height of about 1 meter. I landed softly upon the ground, however, without incident. I found that I must learn to walk all over again. My muscles were used to the gravity of Earth. Mars has less gravity. My attempts to walk resulted in jumps and hops, which took me into the air. I once landed on my face. I soon learned that it took much less effort for me to move on Mars than it did on Earth. Near me was a small, low wall. Carefully, I made my way to the wall and looked over. It was filled with eggs, some already broken open. Small, green creatures were in them. They looked at me with huge red eyes. As I watched the fierce-looking creatures, I failed to hear 20 full-grown Martians coming from behind me. They had come without warning. As I turned, I saw them. One was coming at me with a huge spear, with its sharp tip pointed at my heart.
This is Bob Doty. You have been listening to American Stories and our version of A Princess of Mars. The voice of John Carter was Shep O'Neill. Our program was written for radio, produced and directed by Paul Thompson. Join us again next week for the next part of the Edgar Rice Burroughs story, A Princess of Mars, on the special English program, American Stories, on the Voice of America.